Welcome to this podcast episode of Narcissists in Divorce, The Narcissist Trap. I'm Dr. Supriya McKenna. I'm a former family doctor, but my life's true work is working with people who have fallen prey to narcissistic relationships of any kind. But I'm particularly busy in the area of divorce. Over the last few years, I've been very proud to become an Amazon best-selling author on the subject of narcissism, and my brand new book, Narcissists in Divorce, From Love Locked to Leaving, is out right now on Amazon. That's the first book in the Narcissists in Divorce series, and the follow-on to that will be out in the spring, and that's called Narcissists in Divorce, From Leaving to Liberty. And please do note that although I use the word divorce, these books are equally applicable to anyone leaving a serious intimate relationship with a narcissist, whether they are married or not. I also have a book out called The Narcissist Trap, The Mind-Bending Pull of the Great Pretenders. And that book might be useful in helping the people around you who are supporting you to understand more about what happened to you and about narcissism generally. I'm also the co-author with British divorce lawyer Karen Walker of Narcissism and Family Law, a practitioner's guide. And between us, Karen and I have trained thousands of family law professionals in narcissistic personality disorder, including judges, lawyers, mediators, and social workers. For further narcissism resources from me, please do visit thelifedoctor.org or drsupriya.com, and that web address has the doctor fully spelt out.
So, Supriya, would you say that one of the most difficult groups of narcissists to identify is the one that you refer to as the closet narcissist? When you've looked at the grandiose and other types, the closet I find quite interesting, and it sounds to me as though they are possibly the most difficult to identify and perhaps the one that might fall under the radar. Would that be right?
Oh, that's so true. They are impossible almost to spot if you don't know exactly what you're looking for. And they fly under the radar for decades, literally decades. They're the ones where the penny drops years and years down the line. Something's off, but you can't quite work out what it is for years and years and years. So that they really are incredibly tricky to spot. We refer to them in the book as the closet narcissist, but they're also known as the covert narcissist, or the vulnerable narcissist, or the introverted narcissist. So those are the four different names that they given. It's really important, especially when you're calling them the covert narcissist, It's important to understand that all narcissistic abuse, regardless of the type of narcissist that's doing it, all narcissistic abuse is actually covert. You know, no narcissist goes around with a tattoo on their head saying, you know, these are devaluing behaviours. So all narcissistic abuse certainly starts off very covertly. People do get confused by that. That's why I prefer to call them the closet narcissist. The four types are the exhibitionist narcissist, or the grandiose narcissist, also sometimes called the overt narcissist. Then there's the devaluing narcissist, which is very clearly the Donald Trump type, putting other people down and criticising other people, calling them names, etc., in order to inflate their own ego. And then, of course, you've got the covert or the closet narcissist that we're talking about today, and the altruistic narcissist, who's the one that largely kind of puts themselves out as being the kindest person, the most giving person.
The nicest person in the world,
They'll be the yoga teacher or the meditation teacher or the sort of spiritual. Quite often they take that kind of spiritual element and ham it up, or they can be on committees or etc. The people that do one charity run or marathon after the other, that kind of type. And of course, differently to a true altruist, they're not actually coming at it from an altruistic perspective. They're doing it in order to get that feeling of specialness, so it's not actually true altruism. But the covert type, they tend to sort of seem really quite shy. They just seem like quite nice, self-effacing people. They're quite quiet more often than not. They very much don't seem to want to openly hog the limelight, generally speaking. So they're not the person standing, you know, holding court, telling jokes. They're much, much quieter. And generally speaking, they've attached themselves to someone that they consider to be special. So they often think of themselves as being the wind beneath the wings of another. I think of the doctor's wife or the local politician's wife. And I'm saying wife a lot here, because whereas in some of the other categories, there's a greater proportion of men, certainly with a grandiose or exhibitionist type of narcissist, it's about 75% men. But with a covert type, it's estimated that it's around 50-50, male to female. I think it might actually be slightly more women to men, but I've got no evidence for that whatsoever. But certainly, just from my own experience, it seems to be that there are, you know, there are a large number of women in the covert narcissist category. Because with men, if they're grandiose and they chase wealth and power and status and they openly hog the limelight, that's kind of more socially acceptable for men.
Right.
So it's more socially acceptable for them to present in that way if they're they're a narcissist. Whereas for women, certainly the older age groups, it's not quite so socially acceptable. So their narcissism comes out in this covert closet kind of way.
Yeah.
So they don't openly chase the limelight because of society's norms.
And I guess there might be a change in that because of how society's changing and that the gender roles are altering as we go into the millennial generation coming to the fore. But I think you're absolutely right that in older generations, they seem to me to be very much more the sort of people who are from the point of view of limelight, basking in somebody else's,
absolutely.
That they're getting that side from being, as you say, the sort of the mayor's consort or the role that is second to somebody else from whom they derive the importance. But I think it's this very specific manipulation that goes on behind the scenes that is very, very covertly controlling, because it's not something that's immediately obvious. So if you're the spouse of somebody like this, you may feel that actually there's been something very wrong for a long time, but you can't quite put your finger on it, and that you seem to have been married to a kind, nurturing, helpful person, but you know all the time that there's been something not quite right with this. And I guess it takes much longer to become aware of it and to take the view that actually I can't tolerate this anymore, because it's so subtle. I mean, we talked about the narcissistic abuse being a little bit like putting the frog into very cool water to start with and turning that heat up very, very gently.
Exactly.
But actually, this is the supreme example of it, I think,
and
that it's so gradual and so under the radar. Much more difficult to spot.
Yeah, it's incredibly subtle.
Precisely.
And of course, it's disguised as victimhood. So they're laying on the guilt and guilt tripping the other person who isn't giving enough. And, you know, they're sort of the person that's just giving, giving, giving all the time to everyone. And they feel so put upon. And, you know, I'm always expected to babysit. And yet really they're always offering to babysit or trying to babysit. And everybody expects me to do everything. And it's very much couched in those terms. So, of course, the spouse is actually feeling very sorry for the person. And they tend to choose people who will try to rescue them as well.
Yeah.
Just like all types of narcissists, they'll go for rescuers. They'll go for people who are endlessly empathic and who will just give more and more and more and try to sort of make things better and love more and more and more. And the covert narcissist just kind of sucks all of that out of their partner. Because they seem so pleasant on the surface, people superficially will just say, but you know, he or she is a delight, you know, that, you know, they're a wonderful cook, or they're great at doing the decorating, and they care so much about the family, and you know, the family is everything to them. That's another big thing with these types. They really hold up the family, this perfect family. In fact, that whole thing of the family needing to be absolutely perfect, and they put out this image to the world, it's not just their own false persona, it's like the whole of the family has to be roped into this massive kind of false persona that covers the entire family. We are the perfect family, even though behind closed doors, of course, you know, that's not true at all. But we need to put out this image of being the perfect family. And that's another kind of giveaway, really. If the family sort of are falling into that trap, and they're all manipulated into falling into that trap, and they don't want to upset the parent by not doing the things that the parent is asking of them. So, you know, everybody needs to be together at Christmas at the parent's house, for example, and full stop, or they all need to sort of turn up to weddings as one big unit and stay in the same hotel and all be dancing together at the, you know, at the reception and as this image of the one big happy family. All of that right. is kind of manipulated by the covert narcissist, and everybody feels that they have to do it because otherwise they'll really upset that right. person.
Yeah, who is playing the victim and who will be guilt tripping.
Exactly.
So in the context of a divorce situation where a solicitor is meeting a client for the first time, I'm thinking that actually they are the people who will be very much projecting. So they are highly likely to come in and acclaim that it's their spouse that is narcissistic, that they are the victim, that they've been suffering abuse, trying to get you very much on their side to see that they've been treated in this terrible way. Would that be one of the things to look out for, do you think?
Definitely. As we've said before, certainly for the lawyers, when somebody comes into the lawyer's office and says, I think my spouse is a narcissist, there's a chance that they may actually be the narcissist themselves and they're projecting. So that makes things very, very difficult. But I think it is the closet type of narcissist that tends to do that, that tends to project their narcissism onto their spouse when they turn up to see their divorce lawyer. Because the closet narcissist very much is the type that plays the victim. That's a really, really big part of what they do. I mean, all narcissists play the victim. It's one of the things in the toolkit, but it's particularly prominent with the closet narcissists. And they have no idea in the main that they're projecting. So they'll turn up and they'll say, I think my spouse is a narcissist. And they'll have a list of behaviours, which are probably behaviours that they've carried out themselves. But in fact, you know, it transpires that they are the narcissist. I mean, this must have happened to you many, many times. What do you look out for in terms of closet narcissism, if someone comes to see you and says that their spouse is a narcissist?
Well, I think it's very much, as you say, this presentation as the victim and the fact that they will almost have a clear understanding of what it is they've been dealing with. I think you tend to find that those who are genuinely the victims of narcissistic abuse don't really know what they've been subjected to, except that it's been ghastly and debilitating and they need to get out of it. But they don't always properly understand what it is that has been happening to them. So they'll describe scenarios and events to you as their lawyer, but they won't label it. And I think the big difference is that the closet narcissist arrives almost telling you exactly what it is that they've had to endure and why, and telling you from a very informed position that this is what they've been having to deal with. And it's very different. It feels hugely like projecting rather than their own personal experience. You'll tend to find that the closet narcissist will speak from a position not of vulnerability, but quite a surprisingly assured position for someone who is telling you that they've had such a terribly hard time of it and that they've been subjected to this atrocious behaviour for many, many years. It won't come across in the same way.
As you say, it's almost like a sort of, it's like a box ticking exercise almost. Oh, they triangulated me, they devalued me. They know what to say.
Matter of fact way. Yeah.
Yes, and there's no emotional reaction. You can't feel the emotion.
That's exactly the point. There's no emotional connection to what they're telling you.
Yes.
And there's no emotional fallout. And so it's presented in a much more matter-of-fact way. And I think that's one of the important things about listening.
They just don't seem as upset by it. So the real victim of narcissistic abuse, and they may be very well informed, so they may well have done lots of research, and you know, a friend might have told them they suspect that their spouse is a narcissist, so they may have done lots of research and they may think, oh my gosh, it's true, they are a narcissist. But the difference is that because they've had years of being in that situation, they kind of flit between are they, aren't they. You know, it's really hard to resolve the two versions of that spouse in their heads, because there is that Jekyll and Hyde quality very much so, because of that, the cycle of idealize and devalue that they're put through, where they're love bombed and then they're devalued. So they there's very much that Jekyll and Hyde thing going on, and they can't quite reconcile that. So one minute they're sure and then the next minute they're not sure, and they think they're the narcissist. And you can sense that confusion and that sort of despair.
Oscillating.
And
also, I think that the genuine victim doesn't want to be a victim. I think that's one of the big differences. They don't want it to be true.
Yes.
If you're wondering whether your partner really is a narcissist, please do check out my online course, Is My Partner a Narcissist? Knowing for Sure. And if you want to understand narcissistic behaviours, you may be interested in my Demystifying the Narcissist online course. Both are available on drsapria.com.
It's embarrassing. I think they find it embarrassing. Yes. You know, how could I have let this happen? How could I not have seen this? You know, they want to rise above it. Yeah. They don't want to just fall down under
Also, I think from the lawyer's perspective, it's the closet narcissists who are much more likely to devalue you more quickly if you don't play their game, if they feel that you're not being manipulated in your role as the lawyer. Mm-hmm. In that if it looks as though you're not falling for the, or you're questioning what they're saying to you, or you're testing some of the information that's being provided and not simply accepting it, they'll quickly turn on you. I think it's also important to think about, you know, very often clients will bring somebody else to a meeting or a Zoom call with them. And very often that can be a parent. And 9 times out of 10, those parents are massively supportive, often paying the legal fees, very, very helpful. But every now and again, there is something quite unattractive about this alleged parental support. And again, if you listen and watch carefully, you may find that actually it's not your client that's the victim of narcissistic abuse necessarily in their personal relationship with their spouse or their partner. But it actually may be that the dynamic, which is so toxic, is between your client and their parent, and that actually the parent is manipulating their child either out of a marriage or trying to manipulate their personal life generally, and that's something to be very, very careful of.
So that's when the parent would be saying, well, my child's former spouse is a narcissist. But actually, it could be that they are projecting it almost sort of, it's almost skipped a generation. Yeah. It's really difficult, isn't it? You have to take what you're being told at face value.
Of course you do.
But equally, if the emotion isn't there, if they're playing the victim and saying, you know, this has happened, that's happened, you know, and it, you get a sense that it's just bad acting or it's over the top, then I think that's definitely one way to sort of identify or help identify a closet narcissist. But also, their sense of entitlement comes through, I think, really, really strongly. It still comes through. So they will say things. And I've had clients who've said things to me that, you know, that have made me realise that they were, in fact, narcissistic. So along the lines of, why should my ex-husband get any of the house? I should be able to live in the house forevermore, mortgage-free, and he should go and live in a studio flat in somewhere really terrible. So that's again a common thing that they'll be saying, you know, they're a narcissist and poor me and all of this, but then their sense of entitlement shines through very, very clearly. They'll say things like, I've got 5 bank accounts, you know, but he doesn't know about 4 of them, so is it okay if I just don't mention any of that? Or I earned this money and I put it aside and he knows nothing about it, you know, I'm going to just hide that kind of thing. All the classic behaviors of narcissists, they'll actually come out with it.
And so I guess from the lawyer's perspective, so if you're faced with the covert narcissist as your client, it's very much this lack of empathy when they're telling the story, playing the victim, but with none of the attributes that go with a real victim. So none of that oscillating between not wanting to believe that this is true, embarrassed by finding themselves in this situation. It's being told to you in a much more matter-of-fact way. If you're acting for the spouse of the covert narcissist, I think Even more so, they're going to be very confused by what they've been presented with. And you may find that it's not in your initial consultation with that client, but further down the line, that you'll start to realize what they've been subjected to that possibly will come out through the correspondence. My experience has shown that it starts that within the correspondence, there's this real victim feel for the other person needing something or needing some support or involvement from your client that just doesn't feel quite right. And the covert narcissist is probably still wanting to manipulate your client and draw them back into doing what they want them to do. And I think you'll find that starts to ring out from the correspondence that you receive from the other side. The sort of, oh, you know, I'm in the matrimonial home, but let's say my husband needs to come back every Saturday to mow the grass because I can't possibly do it. And if we're going to sell the house, to keep pulling them back into doing what their spouse wants them to do and maintaining that manipulation. But I think it will start to become more clear as the case progresses and as you see the tone of what's coming from the other side.
Yeah. And again, that's true of all narcissists. Again, you know, that looking at what the sorts of things that are coming from the other side and all the classic behaviours, you know, stealing the money, having a sense of entitlement and wanting everything, using the children as weapons of abuse, all of those things, a covert narcissist will do just as much as all the other types of narcissists, but under the guise of victimhood, that's the difference.
Very much so.
It's not just out and out with an exhibitionist narcissist, it's out and out, or a devaluing narcissist. You know, it's just war. It's openly war. There's no disguise whatsoever, but with a covert, all the same things are happening, but wearing that under that cloak of victimhood
and niceness, sort of being supremely nice.
Yeah. Most narcissists, certainly with the lawyer or with any relationship, they start off by not quite love bombing, but idealizing you, telling you how wonderful you are. I'm always slightly wary when someone comes to me and they're gushing about, you know, I've read your book and you're amazing and you're doing amazing things for the world. And sometimes that's a cultural thing. Sometimes it's just their personality. But there's a little alarm bell that goes off, and I watch extra carefully if they start out in that vein. Because it can quite often be that they are a covert narcissist and they're projecting everything onto their spouse, and that becomes clear fairly quickly. Well, once you know what you're looking for, it's you know, it's in within a conversation that you can actually tell, because they give you little clues right away, really.
That's right. And I think another tool for the lawyer is not to be afraid to just talk a bit about how the couple first met. You know, where did you meet? How did you meet? How did the relationship start? Because often there can be some clues in that information.
Definitely. The love bombing is key. There's no situation at all in a romantic relationship that I've ever come across where the narcissist hasn't love bombed the other party. That is absolutely a key element. So, you know, finding out about that is really a very good thing to do. You know, did you spend 24 hours a day together? Did they shower you with gifts? You know, did they spend every waking moment with you? Did they give you compliments, you know, day and night? Pretty much everybody says that they thought they'd found their soulmate. Was there what you considered to be a soulmate connection? Did you start believing in soulmates when you met this person? That's a classic giveaway, because most relationships don't actually start in this massive kind of ball of fireworks. They are a much more of a slow burn. Did they move in, you know, just a few weeks after getting to know each other, or a few months after getting to know each other? Did they make promises of eternal love within the first few weeks? All those things are really big red flags of a narcissistic relationship. So that love bombing is, I think, one of the most important things to look out for, because all romantic relationships with a narcissist, whether covert or otherwise, start in that way.
And so I think as the lawyer, it is really important to ask those questions, which don't really feature on our new client checklist.
Exactly.
Yes, you'll ask about a period of cohabitation and when they were married and how many children and how old everybody is and so on. But I think drilling down a little bit more into the detail of how did this relationship start will really give you some clues which can be invaluable.
And just to sort of throw in something else here, people often ask me whether two narcissists can be in a relationship together. And the answer is a covert and an exhibitionist narcissist actually make a reasonable couple, because the covert narcissist is drawn to the exhibitionist narcissist's specialness. So they don't know they're a narcissist, but they're drawn to that special quality that the narcissist, the exhibitionist narcissist exudes, because obviously that's what covert narcissists are drawn to, someone else's specialness, so they can bask in the reflected glory without openly seeking the limelight. And the exhibitionist narcissist, you know, they've got this person that's, that seems to be kind of giving and self-effacing and seems like quite a good victim, really. They're both putting each other on a pedestal. They're both devaluing each other and going round and round in the cycle of idealize and devalue. And it's an utterly toxic relationship. They both end up absolutely hating each other. But because they've got this extremely unhealthy, mutually codependent relationship, these relationships can go on forever.
That dynamic may in fact stay together.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Mm. They do. Mm. I mean, they hate each other, but they very, very often will stay together. Narcissists cannot bear abandonment. It's the biggest fear that they have. They already, underneath their, whatever their false persona is, they're already feeling unworthy. They have low self-esteem. They feel great shame, all of those things they don't want to feel. And that's why they put up this image to the outside world, so that everybody believes in the image and then they can believe in it themselves and they don't have to face their own feelings of inadequacy. So it's all about that. And so abandonment is just the absolute biggest form of narcissistic injury that a narcissist can have inflicted upon them. And so you've got two narcissists in this awful dynamic of the covert and the exhibitionist, or the closet and the exhibitionist, both fearing abandonment, hugely fearing abandonment. So that's why they can really kind of stick together forever, even though it is utterly toxic and just a dreadful scenario for everybody involved.
That's interesting.
My brand new book, Narcissists in Divorce, From Lovelocked to Leaving, is out now. For more information and online courses about narcissism, please do check out my websites, thelifedoctor.org or drsapria.com.